Thieves, a novel by Valerie Werder. Part 1, Taking Some Time Off. Valerie often played a game. Because the game had no other players, she didn't feel obliged to give it a name or a straightforward set of rules. The goal was this: to gut herself of her usual contents and become another thing entirely, by taking the subway to an unfamiliar station and wandering its vicinity in concentric circles, no thoughts in her head, or by sitting through a matinee at the theater on 6th Avenue and draining herself of language until she was, at most, a mass of buzzing static in a creaking seat. She didn't entirely believe the game. The problem wasn't its premise. Likely depriving a body of its context and contents would transform it into something other than it was. No, the problem was much more practical. The game was, at the end of the day, impossible to play for real. Valerie couldn't scoop out her insides or turn herself placeless. Whatever she was, she couldn't get rid of her body. She didn't remember how it started. Maybe in response to a phrase encountered on a motivational poster in her high school girl's locker room, or as an epigraph to a soft cover self-help book in her analyst's foyer. Wherever you go, there you are, or there's no escaping yourself. Likely she'd lodged complaints against the poster while pulling on ankle socks or straining to overhear her analyst analyze the preceding patient. Likely she'd interrogated the poster or book on who its addressee, that slippery you, actually was. Most games begin innocently enough. Valerie found herself gradually forced to up the no-context game stakes to reap its rewards. The last time she'd played had also been the most serious. She sat at her desk at work, tracking the receptionist, Sylvie, on the art gallery's surveillance footage software. It was, by all metrics, a normal workday. Valerie assembling strings of words meant to sell objects, Sylvie orchestrating deliveries and recognizing recognizable faces at the front desk. At 2 p.m., the swarm of pixels that spelled Sylvie stepped outside for a smoke break, and Valerie hurried downstairs to join her. The two walked in diagonals around each other to ward off the late winter cold, amusing themselves by comparing stories. Sylvie: I have to research and order at least 12 different brands of espresso from 5 different countries because the Japanese collector was offended that Emilio only had Ethiopian when he came to look at the Basquiat. Valerie: Did you hear that Nick had to fly to Milan yesterday to pick up the catalogs for the opening? Out of the blue. They didn't even let him go home to change. And he didn't have time to leave the airport once he got there. The printer met him outside Terminal 1 with a box, and he caught the red eye back an hour later. Sylvie: FedEx couldn't ship the catalogs here in time? Valerie: They're big books, really heavy. Flying them out was cheaper. They're at my desk if you want to come take a look. Sylvie: Fuck, I wish I'd known. I would have asked him to get some coffee from the duty-free while he was at it. Bet the Japanese don't mind an Italian espresso. She stopped and took a drag to finesse her joke. Ah, shit. Never mind. Italian espresso could have been grown anywhere, huh? Valerie: Yeah, anywhere except Italy. Valerie returned to her desk and stared at the catalogs in their mute brown boxes, sealed with shiny packing tape and stamped in 2 languages from international travel. She had written these books, the catalog texts, the introduction by the gallery owner, and the neatly laid out and illustrated chronology charting the artist's life. The main essay by the famous academic, a former professor of hers, who had told her that he was busy, much too busy to compile my notes into a proper text, but perhaps you'd like to take a stab at it. She took a stab at it, scrapping his notes and inventing anew, and he thanked her for being a wonderful copy editor and barely touching his words at all, and she sealed the envelope containing his $7,000 fee and instructed the designer as to how large, precisely, the byline should be. She paid for image rights, checked captions and citations, organized the material in chronological order, situated the story she'd created into the larger story, the better story, the story of art. She wrote the press release, made up quotes about how pleased the gallery was, so pleased, to represent the artist, and how thrilled the estate was, so thrilled, to work with the gallery. She drafted sales pitches and highlights lists, conducted interviews from the gallery owner's email address with reporters who addressed her by the gallery owner's name. Dear Helene, the exhibition would be good. The work would sell. Valerie hadn't seen the paintings in person. She hadn't needed to. The language wrote itself. The catalogs stared back at her, stupid lumps. It wasn't necessary to open the boxes to look at the books. They would look like all the other books she'd edited for the gallery, printed and bound in Milan by a man named Massimo, front cover dedicated to a detail of the show's most expensive painting, the essay wearing her professor's name careful to emphasize. And she remembered him quoting the phrase when she ran into him at the bar earlier that week, remembered their horrible fight. That the work playfully subverted the rigid codes of body, identity, and representation. In that moment, she knew. She'd made up this story as she'd made up any other. Though the books had the look and feel of seriousness, they'd been chauffeured here for the opening only to be displayed in a stack and then given, gratis, to collectors who'd take them home and throw them out, or else set them up on their Sarfati side tables, spines uncracked, simulations of artworks decorating living rooms, while the collectors phoned their accountants and consulted advisors to move around funds, inquire about markets, take the requisite steps to buy the real thing, to ship it to the Freeport and allow it to sit in storage, mutely absorbing that year's taxes. Razor calm, Valerie gathered her belongings, avoiding the gaze of the boxes, not telling Sylvie or her manager or anyone. She left in the middle of the workday. The afternoon was cold and bright. She walked to a nearby bookstore and browsed the aisles with clear, unhurried intent. Books organized according to profit reports and Amazon ratings, names extolling other names stamped on each cover. The sales game, again, here. Ted said there was a fundamental difference between winning a game and beating it. Those who wanted to win agreed with the game's terms, molding themselves to its rules. Those who wanted to beat a game, though, were playing at something much greater. They were troubling the perimeter of the knowable world. Valerie toyed with a blue and green paperback, its cover declaring it wild, exhilarating, fresh. According to Ted, winning would be having the money to buy the book, the brains to read it, and the well-appointed apartment in which to display it. Neither a wild nor an exhilarating future for the book, Valerie thought. Surely it deserved a life adequate to its own promise. She selected a book whose hard cover was patterned in geometric pink and orange and, casually, angling herself just so, dropped it into her bag. Still not as smooth as Ted, she knew, but Ted, who was tall and dexterous and almost comically handsome in his cowboy boots and worker's overshirt, had advantages. He was the most skilled shoplifter she'd ever met, and, though she hadn't met many, she'd wager he was the best in all of New York, minimum, if only because of his grace. In the early days of their relationship, if it could be called that, a relationship, Valerie and Ted were walking down Bleecker Street when a man, lumbering and pockmarked, stopped them, calling out an old nickname more to some invisible witness than to Ted himself. "Hey-o, Sneak Attack, is that you, Sneak Attack Smith?" Hands bloated and sweating, he grabbed Ted's shoulder, shaking him, telling him that his high school wrestling pictures were still on their old gymnasium's walls. "Can't believe you're in the Big Apple, too," he said, before admitting he was only there on a family vacation. "Can't believe you made it out of that place alive." When they got home, Ted stripped his pants, laughing, to reveal blood trickling down his legs. Big, glistening stains on his thighs, drips crossing his shins in deep red webs. He walked to the bathroom to shower, and Valerie watched it run down his ankles and hit the floor in small, dark drops. He'd stuffed dozens of dainty and disc-shaped steaks, raw, down his jeans at the Gristeds on 9th before meeting up with her. "I felt it happen when that guy hugged me," he said, mopping lines of steak juice with his palm. "He squeezed so hard the wrappers broke." Ted moved not like a wrestler, but a modern dancer, a Martha Graham trainee, his gestures precisely attuned to every interlocutor, every situation. Were he at the bookstore with Valerie now, he might have picked off a shelf of books in full view of the security camera, all the while chatting up a salesperson in the next aisle. Valerie shifted her bag, considerably heavier now, and rearranged the shelf. She didn't want any of these books. She'd taken the pink and orange bestseller only as a token, a reminder that being sold something doesn't necessarily mean you have to buy it. The Getting Game, as she and Ted called it, did have a few rules, based more on the cosmic laws of the universe, karma and all of that, than in human norms and standards. For example, if you steal for any reason besides really needing what you take, you have to either A, buy something small as an offering to the economic system you're cheating, or B, give away another stolen object to a person who doesn't know how you obtained it. Of course, the rule's conditional term, really needing what you take, allowed ample room for interpretation, and Ted rarely followed his invented rules anyway, though he attributed every misfortune or close call to their trespass. Ted was the sort of person who seriously believed that he was at the mercy of hidden forces greater than himself. Not in a New Agey, ayahuasca retreat in Peru kind of way, but in the desperate manner of bums and wanderers who have to stake their bets on something, being unable to stake them on a bank account, a job, a stable group of age-appropriate friends. Valerie was the sort of person who followed rules. She browsed her way to the bookstore's cafe and bought an apple, 75 cents, which she took to the ladies' room. Offering in hand, she sat pants down on the toilet as a barrage of messages and emails from the gallery came through. "Urgently need sales packet for Richter viewing. Helene looking for you. Where have you gone? Where are you now?" Where had she gone? And where was she now? Why here and not somewhere else? Why herself and not anyone else? "Hey, you hiding inside the Terrell?" Sylvie texted. The gallery's March show, as Valerie had described it in the press release, interrogated the conceptual and spatial poetics of the void. A corner of the second floor had been partitioned by James Terrell's assistants to create an enveloping dark space cut by two thin violet lines. Sylvie had taken to climbing inside the installation at least twice a day, for power naps, she said. "Nope, went for a walk," Valerie replied, and then, "I think I'm gonna quit." "Right now? What for?" Sylvie responded. "Who's gonna finish the Richter packet?" Valerie had neither a reason nor a backup copywriter in mind. "I'm fed up." "You're gonna get a job at another gallery?" "No, I guess not." "So you'll finish the packet today?" The ellipses beside Sylvie's name paused, disappeared, reappeared, and then a longer text came in. "You should ask for a sabbatical. Say it's for health reasons. I heard they paid Francoise to go to a spa in the Black Forest for 3 months last year to heal some sort of liver imbalance. Valerie sent the conversation careening back into its speech bubble icon and clicked the envelope on her screen, making it vibrate and bounce before releasing it to compose an email. Subject line: sabbatical request. She'd been constipated, but now, as she wrote, her swollen bowels moved. Valerie recalled that the dying often defecate in the moment of passing from life to death. She might take this as a sign, lumps heavy in the bowl indicating a transition, a new act in her narrative arc, the body announcing itself in its expulsions, collusions with bacteria and fungi, harbingers of the hidden. Valerie picked up her bag, book secured inside, and flushed the toilet. She couldn't convince herself that her shit meant anything at all.